Leroy and Khalil, I want to go to the telephone lines because apparently we have a couple of callers. A couple other issues I want to raise, which we get around to. But let's say welcome the first caller for the morning and say good morning and welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Morning, sir.
Right. Yeah, good morning. What's actually the theme, though?
I'm sorry?
What's actually the theme of the program?
Okay. All right. Well, if you're not familiar with the theme, maybe you want to give way to somebody else.
I thought I heard someone said even before program. They're talking about the borrow and the introduction of free education. That's you're why I actually called.
No, his vision for education.
His vision for education.
Yeah. Oh, if you want to speak to it, go ahead and speak to it. If not, just give way because
That's right. I won't talk. Speak about it. Now, I'm wondering why people give borrow so much credit for free education in Barbados. Barbados did not begin in 1961. No, I heard this bandit about even for the morning talking about the University of West Indies. Borrowing had a significant impact on the University of West Indies. These foremost persons in the establishment of the UV in Barbados was Princess Anne, Dr. Williams, and Dr. Sir Arthur Lewis, Treadles. Barbados was picked as a site to help that the people in the OECS will also use UVA as their university. Pre-education in Barbados was introduced by Sir Gradley Adams in 1962. Barrow didn't even in office yet, right? You had about 5 or 6 secondary schools that Sir Gradley introduced. He introduced St. Leonard's Boys and Girls in 1962, Gradley Adams in 1955, Princess Margaret in 1955, Parkinson in 1960, Coleridge and Parry was also in 1965. So that was the introduction of free secondary education in Barbados. Now, what Barrow did not the introduction of free secondary education in Barbados, because he came haphazardly and just said he's going to make the older secondary schools free. But will you believe it? He made a proclamation in 1962 that there'd be free, there'd be no paying of salary fees at schools. By 1965, 3 years later, he had to introduce a system where he had to pay extended to the said schools. Because
Before you go in, Leroy, let me just say to the caller that I acknowledge your historical reflection, but I really don't know that's going to help us get anywhere. And I don't want to get into a conversation today about who did what. Some of what you're saying is inaccurate. Some of what you're saying is accurate. But I think the more important point is that we not look back, but we look forward. We are asking questions regarding the relevance of Barrow's vision for the future. And the idea of going into details about who started free education, who did this, who did that, isn't going to help us. The question is, how do we go forward? So, caller, let me thank you for your contribution this morning. And let's see if we can get another caller. Is there anything you wanted to say, Leroy? Before we go?
You see, Peter, I am not going to comment on the only thing I would like to say about that contribution that we're in now, because there are people who would reduce everything to political piffle. Yeah. And you know, it is unfortunate that here it is, we are trying to look at education and what is the role of education towards our development. And somebody's going to come with this. Who introduced what when, and bringing a lot of unnecessary inaccuracies. But
let's move on. And I made the point that when we introduced the panel, I did not speak about the political lineage of anyone.
Exactly.
Leroy worked for Arrow Barrow. I did say that George worked for David Thompson, our friend of Stuart, but and Khalil has his own political perspective, but we're not here about that today. We're here about education and how we can carry the whole thing forward. So let's have another caller. Good morning and welcome. You're on the program. Good morning and welcome. You're on the program. Okay, I don't know if there's another caller there. I believe Dennis told me that we have about two people waiting to get in. So can you go right ahead, please? If not, let's give way to the next person.
Hello.
Hi, good morning. Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
We're great. We're great.
Good morning.
That Leroy McLean there too?
Yes, it
He's
is.
There, yeah.
Yeah, Leroy.
Hello.
That's for my thunder, but thanks for doing it, though. They responded to the first caller. Now, I thank Mr. Barra for everything that he did. Right? And when somebody starts doing something that's good, I see whoever come along should build upon it. Just how Mr. Barra built on what was done before he took over, government is really continuing, you know. And as you progress, you're going to get younger minds with fresher ideas. But I agree with him when he spoke about who did who and all that. This is not the time for that. This is not the time just because you support a party. Anybody got a right to support a party. But don't try to discredit people because they don't belong to the club that you belong to. I'm against that. Talk about no. And maybe look back. Sometimes I even tell myself when they look back and see the things that Mr. Barr did. And the way some people have turned out, as someone says, I think he did too much.
All right, Mr. P, thanks for your contribution to the program. I'm being told that George is there. Is George available? He's not there yet. Okay, no, he was telling me that he was trying to get into the program, so I'm not sure of the situation. All right, good morning and welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Good morning, Peter Wickham and panel.
Morning,
good morning.
Ma'am.
Good morning.
I recognize his voice. Welcome.
Okay, this is. I just wanted to make three comments, please. Earlier, Mr. Mm-hmm. Wickham, you talked about Sir Sanford talking about possibly using the community college as an opportunity to equalize the schools. And I'm thinking that maybe we have a second opportunity at it if we look at making maybe the Queen's College and the arts and colleges of this world A-level institutions. They already carry the name College Against St. James, and maybe we can look back at something like that, and all the other schools would take it to a whole level.
Mm-hmm.
The other point I have is that maybe COVID is just the perfect storm for online teaching. You see, I feel somehow that we can standardize delivery of subjects to students online. But there are some teachers who do not like online. There are some teachers who are not comfortable with the multimedia. And if we can deliver certain subjects, regardless of school, if that can be delivered full multimedia first, and then the teachers who are more, who are better at teaching one-on-one, we have them teach their classes after the fact, but there might be some subjects that, regardless of what school you go to, whether it's an older secondary school or one of the newer ones, that you can actually benefit from standardized full multimedia, because a lot of students still go on to YouTube and they watch the subjects all over again in a multimedia format. So I'm thinking that perhaps multimedia delivered across all the schools for some subjects might maybe of benefit to some students to help us with this standardization. And I really never realized that the screening test was to determine if a child can go forward to do an exam or not. And I think that is very useful, and maybe we need to revert back to the original intent of that screening test. And my last point has to do with a comment made that CSC needs to now listen to the governments of the Caribbean and develop programs around what they might want for their people. And I want to say that I fully agree with that. I would also say, though, that CSC needs to also pre-qualify persons for universities overseas. So as much as they also develop programs that will be acceptable to us, we also want a mechanism where they can deliver material that if someone wants to go on and further their studies, that it is of a particular standard around the world. So they too need to be looking around and see how other universities might be changing their programs and the new prerequisites to get into those programs. So those would be my 3 points. And Mr. Wickham, this is my very first time ever calling any program. I was just listening, and I just thought that I would make a contribution.
Ma'am, I'm happy that you called. You're not who I thought you were, but I'm happy that you called and that you brought a bit of gender balance to the conversation that we're having. I thought you made some excellent points. I want to respond, but I don't know if Leroy, you want to say, because you've been trying to get him. Yeah,
I would like to respond. The lady makes some interesting points. But what I would say is that she made the point that about the QC and HC and those schools being sixth form colleges only. Now that puts pressure on, in reality, that will put pressure on the other schools in terms of places, because what do you do with the children of the students now who will be from the first of the fourth or fifth forms in those schools? But the point she made about teachers not being comfortable with the online is really, I think, a sad reflection on what we have been doing so far. There is nobody who has gone through a full secondary and university education and has probably certification in education. Any person who has done that and now cannot deal with the technology related to online teaching, something has to be wrong. Mm-hmm. Because there's no way that you should have gone through this process and are still uncomfortable with using the technology. That should have been part of your training. Because mm-hmm. you understand where the world is going. You can see where the technology is, how the technology is developing. So at least you should be able to manage the those basic things. So, and the other thing is that about CXC pre-qualifying people for overseas universities, most universities around the world accept the qualifications that are given by CXC. In fact, I think that Barbadians, Caribbean people need to understand that the education system in this part of the world is highly recognized anywhere. But we have this self-doubt about what we are capable of. And when we look at the fact that there, per capita wise, I think the English Caribbean has one of the highest number of Nobel laureates in any geographical space. Mm-hmm. When you look at the few people we have in the English-speaking Caribbean and the number of persons who have come out of that population who have become Nobel laureates, we must certainly have something good here, and we need to understand what it is and build it rather than keep pulling down ourselves.
Yeah, we have George now, but I want to go to George shortly, but I want to ask Khalil first, though. As a student at Queen's College, and I know that you can't speak to any other secondary school, but would you say that, and as a young person, would you say that we are making 100% use of this online environment? And do you believe that the way that your teachers grapple with the online environment is up to par? Is it what you would like it to be? Or do you also go to YouTube after a class to see what information you can find?
No, definitely this new environment. As a matter of fact, a lot of referring to it as online into the theory of it. It's actually remote teaching. Because what we have done is we have taken syllabus content that was designed for in-person teaching and transferred that to an online modality. And that is never going to be a seamless transition. So online teaching is where you have a syllabus content that is designed expressly to be taught using the online modality. So we are grappling in a crisis environment with doing, I think, in many respects, the best that we can do. This new phase has highlighted persons, really and truly, the unfamiliarity of people, not only teachers, but also young people, you'd be surprised, unfamiliar with quite basic technologies, because we spend a lot of our time, when we think of technology, we spend a lot of time on social media sites and things like that. But that really and truly is not the full extent of the offering that you have on technology and that is available technologically. So you have a lot of children unable to use Word or finding it difficult to use word processing software or spreadsheet software, things like that. You have difficulty with respect to uploading documents. Some students finding it difficult to do so. So you have all of these problems that are highlighting that even our young people are not fully prepared for this online modality. So that it once again, it gives us a moment for pause, I think, to, we have this opportunity. We can use this to instruct our teachers and instruct our students in how to best utilize this new framework that, well, it was previously hybrid, but now obviously with the challenges fully online. And that, I think, is the challenge going forward. So persons are still in this crisis mode. They're trying to do the best that they can under this situation. But going forward for the longer term, if we want to make this a part, and we certainly should make it a part of our educational experience, we have to relook at curricula in the first instance to make it able to be delivered online, as well as looking at better training our citizens, young and adult, in the use of the various technologies.
Okay, I want to respond quickly to the caller, and as again, I want to thank her for you know, injecting some interesting perspectives. And this whole idea of what to do with QC and EHC in a system that does not recognize or that recognizes all schools as being equal is one that has come up over and over again. She's made one suggestion, which is, you know, allow them to teach only A levels. I am not really sure that is not something that is being done already to some extent, because we have A level offering across the board now. Alexandra Foundation, etc., are now offering A levels. My concern is that there is a fundamental challenge now where we have a level of duplication in the traditional subject offerings for advanced level with what is being done in all the secondary schools and also at the Barbados Community College. So I think that we have to rationalize the post-secondary, where in some instances we're doing the CAPE, and in some instances we're doing an associate degree. And we have to ask ourselves maybe whether we shouldn't be doing one or the other. Why do we necessarily have to be doing both and replicating the same subjects at all the other schools? The difficulty I also have with that is that I think there is a presumption that you can specialize in the traditional A-level subjects, and that is the be-all and the end-all of post-secondary education. I have some problems with that, because I've made, over time, note of the fact that some of our most outstanding contributions have come from people like Nicholas Branca and Arturo Tappan. This is long before Rihanna was a factor, suggesting that there clearly is a need for us to develop particular music skills. There's a need for us to develop sporting skills. I mean, we had Obadiah Thompson and others who were outstanding sports people. There's a need for us to develop arts, the creative arts, in a serious way at the post-secondary level. And I am not convinced that the current structure takes that into consideration, because it forces you into one or the other, and it doesn't give you the opportunity to explore these kinds of novel areas. So my thing is, if we're going to develop a center of excellence for the arts, and a center of excellence for the sciences, where we allow people to specialize in those things, then we also need to have a center of excellence for fine arts, a center of excellence for music, a center of excellence for sports, because there's no presumption that a student who specializes in sport is necessarily any brighter or less bright or any less able to make a contribution. This is a question of what the talents are. And I feel that we need to ensure that the less well-known talents are also nurtured by our educational system. And then the other point about Caribbean Examination Council, look, CXC and the West Indies Cricket Board have essentially been affected by a virus that impacts on regional institutions. And when you look at regional institutions across the world, there comes a point when they develop a personality of their own. The United Nations has done it over time, where you develop a personality to the point where you are not a tool of the governments, but you become an institution in and of yourself. And I believe that the Caribbean Examination Council is at that crossroads now, where it is not necessarily reflecting government policy or government ambitions, but it's essentially standing as an institution and saying to government, look, we will do this and we will do that. And that is the reason why we're having this issue with the exam results.
And there is absolutely no way.
It's a huge problem, because there's no way in 2021 an institution that is established to facilitate the developmental needs of Caribbean children should be telling the governments of those Caribbean children, what we will do is we will give you a remark and we will not consider the fundamental issue or the fundamental problem, because they're not responsive, and they don't have to be, because they have individual budgets, they have a way of being able to charge fees, and they can sustain themselves without necessarily having to look for governments for the oxygen that is needed to carry them forward. And there's a virus that has to be stamped out. I think that we have to be aware of where they're going. I mean, Khalil will not realize this yet, but this is basically the problem that CXC is having. You've seen it in cricket with the West Indies Cricket Board. But the thing is, the West Indies Cricket Board is that it also has an independent funding to some extent, and can essentially almost tell governments what it will and won't do in relation to the development of the entity that they want to develop. But we want to get George Pilgrim in. Now, George is on the line. George, thanks for joining us. He was actually in a meeting, or will be in a meeting at some point in time. So he's just with us for a short period. George would be one of the Dipper's children, like myself. And I'm hoping that, George, in your initial remarks, you can tell us a bit about whether you feel that Arobara's vision, as it was initially articulated, when you yourself as a student at the Queen's College, and then you went on to higher education, do you feel that we have made enough of this foundation that we have been given so many years ago?
Good morning, Peter. Thank you for inviting me. Good morning to the listeners, to my fellow panelists. Happy New Year, Dennis. Haven't heard or seen you in a while. All the best. Peter, you hear me clearly because the Wi-Fi in my area is very awful.
Okay. I'm hearing you fine, George. Yes, George, speak to us.
George, Peter, I'm back.
You have the floor. Yeah.
Peter, I have a slightly different view about being a product of Barra's educational legacy. Most of all the literature that I scan about Barra speaks to Barra's intervention at a time when there was a need for change and improvement. And there were great hindrances to the education system back then. So I think what Barra was able to do was to open up. I think he gave a lot of people access to education, not only to education, he also lowered the voting age. So my take on it is the fact that Barra's intervention into the lives of Barbadians made it possible for thousands of people to be educated. The challenge we face, however, is the foundation upon which our education system was built, the inherited structures which continue today. And I'll share with you at some point in during the program some of the views from some authors, historians, about the structure of our education system and the legacy of what it has meant for Barbados.
Mm-hmm. But George, go ahead and share. I mean, you have the floor, so go right ahead.
So I'm looking at the Journal of Negro History, and it's a publication by Robert Proctor. This was written in 1980. And just to praise it very quickly, Proctor is speaking about early education in Barbados. He speaks to the fact that Barbados government today, world, its education system has also helped to support a high degree of political stability and well-disciplined workforce. But the costs in other areas have also been high, especially since independence 1966. He concludes by saying, Barbadians are beginning to focus their attention on the negative aspects of the island's highly stratified social structure and on the loss of the population's rich African heritage. and the impact of the near insurmountable problems that underlie Barbados' economic, social, and political dependence on Britain. Barbadian education standards should and must inevitably explain and examine the history of the system and question just how much of a legacy remains appropriate to the future of Barbados. So the point I'm making to you is that what changes have we really made to the delivery and the content of our education? Peter, some of the same teachers who taught me at Queen's College in the 80s just left school. And to my knowledge, the only subject that has probably left the curriculum at Queen's College is religious education and maybe, not maybe Latin and classics. But other than that, the books are still the same. The delivery is still the same. And I'm going to fast forward. I mean, my kids are home online now. The challenge for my kids online is that the delivery online for them is no different to the delivery for myself online as I deliver to students at University of West Indies. We're using the same Zoom. We are using the same shared screen. We're going for 2 hours in class in some instances. It is very, very difficult for students who are 11 years and under to be focused for that period of time at school in a home environment. It is extremely difficult, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question in my mind that that is certainly a very difficult thing. I mean, in the break, Dennis was making a point about the fact that the Minister of Education, I believe it was Dennis, was suggesting that, you know, we rely a bit on Sesame Street. And I mean, George, you would remember when we were growing up, and certainly Leroy as well, you know, Sesame Street was a significant part of our learning our afternoons after you got home from school, because Sesame Street taught you how to count, and some instances how to count in Spanish and to do other things. Certainly by 2021, we should have been in a position to harness some of our own local creative artists to create content like Sesame Street that speaks to us in a language that we can understand. So instead of it just being entertainment, maybe there's a need for that level of creative input that kind of Caribbeanizes the whole Sesame Street offering. So I'm agreeing entirely that this is one of the areas that we need to go, and that the online content, you know, is challenging. Asking a student who is at primary school to take up an online course is going to be difficult if it is the same information delivered in the same format. And the other point that we have not yet touched on today is that what a prime minister or what a government minister, what a person does is one thing. But the other part of it is what kind of institutional facility is available. I mean, one of my concerns is the ability of a child to follow a program like that. Does he have the correct equipment at home? And does he have the environment at home that would allow him to do so? I mean, Khalil is in a fortunate group where I know that his parents would provide him the necessary infrastructure at home to be able to follow a program properly. But there are a number of children who are not so fortunate, especially in the lower socioeconomic bracket, that don't have a dining room table to sit down around with quiet and peace that they can follow a program on a laptop. They have an area outside the house where people will line, and it is disruptive. They don't have the supervision that is needed from parents who understand the importance of what they're doing. So it makes it hard in that environment to create equality. And I think that government has to step in some instances and create a level of equilibrium in whatever way it can. Or alternatively, do what is being proposed. No, we defer examinations until such a time as we've given everyone the opportunity to have a fair chance, because I don't see realistically how you can have a competitive examination in an environment like this where people are not competing unfairly. And I mean, what is basically going to happen if you can look at 11 plus is that the students who are better off will do better in it. And that's a simple reality of the fact that they have an environment that's more conducive.